Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome, everybody, to Voice Rebellion Radio. It is 3 o'clock Eastern Time, 12 on the West Coast, here on Saturday afternoon, here at Voice Rebellion Radio, live at Stable Radio Replay at UCY.TV, Sunday, 9 Eastern, 6 Pacific Time. This week we're talking about one of the stories that you might have missed was the all the havoc of Hurricane Harvey and all that, as you might have missed about that North Korea launched another missile over Japan. And now we're going to talk about the supposed threat that North Korea has for the United States and whether we should actually be scared of the possibility of war with North Korea or whether we should ignore this like the many other threats that we've seen between the two countries. Now, there's been an escalation in the last few months, partially because usually our leaders, at least in an attempt to try to not look menacing, try to not put rhetoric like Donald Trump put, where he was talking about fire and fury like the world has never seen with North Korea. Ultimately, the whole idea of the United States being like diplomatic and peace wanting factor out of the two, and when it comes to North Korean and Northeast Asian relations in general, is quite false. They have many troops on the DMZ to this day, which has been one of the main demands by Pyongyang, and probably would alleviate a lot of tensions if the United States had to pull their troops out the DMZ or the DMZ. The United States regularly runs drills along the border, with like bomber runs and stuff like that, to simulate the invasion and different scenarios where the United States military would do a military action in North Korea. They're constantly threatening in different ways, and also they're constantly passing crippling economic sanctions against North Korea and many other countries, but North Korea in this situation, which has made their economy ultimately, though, it's made them adapt to where the point where now they have a pretty much sufficient economy. However, there's been at times massive starvation and stuff like that, and it was in due part due to the sanctions of the past in the 90s, plus the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991 led to the North Korea no longer having a major country to trade with, and North Korea was practically left to fend for themselves, leading to a massive starvation in the 1990s, where also a lockdown of the country, further lockdown, and the authoritarian nature of the country built when they introduced the Songun law, which is pretty much like a military law. Before that, it still wasn't one party dictatorship under Kim Il-sung, and then when Kim Il-sung died in 1994, I believe the famine that already started, Kim Jong-il took over the country as son, and that's the one that instituted the Songun policy and got away. It was really implemented on top of their Juche policy, which was the socialist nationalist rhetoric or ideology that was formed in the 1970s by Kim Il-sung for North Korea. However, it should be noted that North Korea till the 1990s was definitely not as authoritarian as it is now, I don't think. And really in comparison to some other regimes around the planet, even to this day, I would not consider it to be the most authoritarian regime. But back then, I don't think it was really anywhere close to somewhere like, for example, like the Gulf states and Saudi Arabia. Nowadays, they definitely have locked down and run a tighter ship than they did in 1985. And also another thing that should be noted is until 1987, South Korea did not have the idea of democracy to hold moral superiority over North Korea because they were also a military dictatorship ran by fascist military junta leaders all the way from the end of the Korean War all the way up to 1987, the last one being Chun Doo-hwan. But I believe he's still alive today. He's got away without actually facing any kind of military or any kind of trials for his military rule. His predecessor was made the most brutal of all the South Korean dictators, Park Chung-hee, who was assassinated in 1979. He was rumored to have killed an entire village for protesting against the regime. I would label him the most severe dictator that the entire Korean Peninsula has ever seen. And also he was a traitor to his country in World War II. The ironic thing is that the United States sided with the guy who was actually an Axis, was on the Axis powers during World War II. He fought for the Japanese and South Korean dictator, while Kim Il-sung was actually fought on our side, on the Allies, was Korean resistance. And he was a guerrilla fighter prior to becoming becoming the leader of North Korea, and then the dictator for, you know, spending 46 years in power from 1948 all the way to 1994. I mean, it was a very long reign of power. However, during the Kim Il-sung regime, I would say that they did go to a very quick recovery of the country compared to the southern counterparts that struggled much tougher than their northern counterparts. However, once the 1980s hit, South Korea moved way forward. The 1980 Olympics happened. They moved way forward, North Korea. Now you see that seems that South Korea is 40, 50 years ahead of North Korea in some regards. But when it comes to some humanitarian concerns, they're not. For example, as they try to make South Korea seem like it's a paradise in the Asian continent, or, you know, just a model, maybe not that far, but they try to make it seem like it's a model that all Asian countries should try to follow, and all Asian countries should strive to become South Korea. However, South Korea has one of the highest suicide rates in the world. They have a large amount of poverty encircling Seoul. They show you all those nice pictures of Seoul with the skyscrapers and the high-tech billboards and all kinds of things like that, but they don't show the shanty towns that surround Seoul, their capital. Ultimately, Seoul is like any other major city in the West that all has a nice downtown, but around it you have major ghettos, slums. In Seoul's case, they have pretty large slums around South Korea. There's still problems with homelessness, and as well, I would say that another major problem that South Korea may face in the future, a problem of reproduction due to the culture degeneration that they've been experiencing with more Japanese modern culture leaking into their country. We see in Japan now, they're talking about the possibility that the race of Japan is going to go extinct by 2050, while South Korea is going to be falling into Japan, even though that they have this weird relationship with Japan, is that military, they're allies, but yet again, Japan and South Korea have tension against each other, very strong tension, really, because Japan occupied Korea and did a 40-year occupation just 70 years ago. So South Korea, they have this weird relationship with Japan, but then there's things they want to emulate a lot of their culture and, you know, a lot of this modern Japanese culture. But ultimately, you know, what I would say is that, you know, a lot of people will say that I'm not being respectful towards it, or that it's their culture now, I should respect it. But to me, it's just going into bizarre world is what Japan is. Same thing with South Korea. They continue following this path, and ultimately, it's going to lead potentially to their extinction of their race if it continues. And wouldn't that be the ironic thing, is that a country that just 70, 80 years ago was so concerned, you know, Japan, they're so concerned about the continuation of the race, and they actually believe, many of them, that they were like the master race, is now potentially going to go extinct altogether if their birth rates keep declining. Their elderly population is soaring. The amount of people living over 65 is incredible in Japan, and ultimately it's becoming overwhelming on their system. I think it's that ultimately the American influence has done that to them, and the Western influence has done that to them. And I think that's why there's a segment of the Japanese population that wants to join hands with Russia for two reasons. One is because they see Russia as more traditional, more conservative socially. If they join Russia, perhaps they can save the Japanese culture and the Japanese people from becoming a thing of the past. For two, if they don't trust the United States, North Korea, and that perhaps the only way to beat North Korea is not a militarization and overspending the fence, peace deals and made in talks, which Russia would be able to broker up between the entire Northeast Asian area. And right now, there's so much tension in that region. You have China and Japan that are tense at each other. You have North Korea and South Korea tense at each other. You have North Korea and Japan tense at each other. And ultimately, the only like alliance that can be really the only alliances are the and often China. Since the conversation, I believe. So ultimately, there's a real alliance that are out of those four countries. And then you also have, you know, also in the mix, you have Taiwan to the south. Now, they have their own set of problems when it comes to Taiwan, China's relationships, and then they don't really have an easy relationship with any of the players, I don't think. May South Korea is the only one out of the Asian players. So ultimately, it's a lot of uneasy alliances and a lot of strong tension and animosity. So maybe perhaps the only thing that could bring peace to the region would be perhaps some through talks, through some bartering, and perhaps Russia the broker to that. So maybe that's perhaps why Shinzo Abe and the government of Japan seems to be wanting to reach out to Russia, because they know that Russia, with their, it's an uneasy alliance right now, but it's been at times stronger, is that Russia is made the only country on the planet that could talk to North Korea in a way where they would be compelled in order to signing a long-lasting peace agreement with Japan, and Japan could be safe. Because here's the thing, is that ultimately, the United States never was to do military action, and they went with some madman scenario and just went in there and started striking targets in North Korea. North Korea has a very high likelihood that in retaliation, they're going to attack. They probably, the thing is that the threat to the United States is kind of overestimated, because it's, they most likely do not have the technology to hit mainland United States, and the technology to hit Guam is potentially not even there. So the United States territories might be completely safe from North Korean military action. However, their allies, South Korea and Japan, are not safe. And ultimately, if that was to happen, a retaliatory strike could definitely hit those two and bombard them. It would be disastrous. So Japan is willing to face the consequences in response to the United States action, such as a military strike against North Korea, because it's not a military strike against Iraq or a military strike against Syria. Both North Korea made it seem that way, that they are willing to retaliate. North Korea has almost played a little bit of a, you know, it's like Nick talked about the madman series. They played an open version of that, and they played pretty much the idea of that, you know, you keep launching the missiles and saying that you're two steps away from nuking someone, and that will cause people to generally bow to your demands. And, you know, I think one of the major things is North Korea wants to be, for a while, be recognized as a state, and the nuclear program be recognized as legal and not illegal. Now, ultimately, the West has no justification to label anyone's nuclear weapons programs as illegal or legal for the most part, because, you know, when you look at how Israel got their nuclear weapons, it was illegally, with the help of traitors in the United States government, and ultimately the South African regime, when they were the apartheid regime, they had nuclear weapons and they got it on behalf of Israel, another illegal nuclear weapon state. They call North Korea a legal nuclear weapon state, but ultimately, is it any more illegal than Israel's or South Africa's nuclear weapons programs? Well, South Africa said they disbanded the nuclear weapons program, but their nuclear weapons program back in the day, is it any more illegal than those two nuclear weapons programs? That's the question. So South Korea, you know, they're ultimately the ones that you'd think is the most scared of the idea of a North Korean strike, but I don't think most of the people, there's been like interviews with these people, and they don't seem to be too scared of the idea of, you know, they're not too scared of North Korea. They don't believe that they're ever going to go through with one of these threats that they have threatened for many years. You know, this is not anything new, North Korea's antics. And I think that's why South Korean physiologically, they'd rather not escalate it. I think a lot of South Koreans, has been shown through rallies and protests, are pretty dissatisfied with the regime's unwillingness to do talks with North Korea and willingness to continue building up missile systems and stuff like that only escalate the tension rather than trying to de-escalate. Trump has talked about giving these people nuclear weapons, you know, Japan, South Korea, to fend off in North Korea. However, that would be disastrous, I would think, because ultimately putting more nukes in that situation is probably not the answer. Spreading out the nukes even further, but ultimately it could backfire big time. Trump, because Japan could potentially join Russia, and it would just be one more nuclear weapon state that would be against the United States government. If Japan was to join Russia, they would be there with us potentially. You know, like I've said before,
I believe it's very possible
that Russia could turn Japan, and actually we could see some kind of weird alliance between the entire Northeast Asian area with Russia. I could see them defusing this whole situation because they have the means to do so. They have enough of an alliance with North Korea to reason with them. They have economic connections in South Korea. They have diplomatic relations and other economic ties. They got a lot of ties actually to Japan. China, of course, we all know that their burgeoning relationship that they've had over the last 10, 15 years and how big that's gotten, they can definitely work with them as a close friend almost in that sense. And I believe they even have, you know, ties to Taiwan. So they can fix up that last broken link. But even with China, they can definitely talk with them and Japan. And there's a definite possibility they could bring peace between China and Japan when there's been this last intention over the disputed islands. And remember, 5 years ago, there was talk that they were even going to go to war, which Japan and China went to war many times over the centuries. And it's last time was a very unfortunate result. When Japan and China went to war, which people don't realize in World War II, just that also happened. Japan and China went to war in World War II. China was an ally, Japan was an axis, and Japan invaded China. They killed 10 million Chinese. They talk about the Holocaust all the time, but they don't talk about the genocide that the Japanese committed against Chinese. They were barbaric. The Japanese government were a barbaric institution that pushed very barbaric methods for the colonization. So that's why I think that, in part, the United States was able to get away with the atomic bomb in Japan, because there was so much hate towards Japan by the end of the war for what their military had done to Asia, that they had done atrocities all across the continent. And, I mean, it's amazing how big the two major Axis powers got during the wars, that you had Germany taking almost all of Europe and stuff in North Africa. They were like as big as the Roman Empire at one point. And then the Japanese Empire had pushed all the way deep into China. They had taken Southeast Asia. They had taken Korea. They had taken many of the Pacific Islands. It was a large portion of the world's territory was controlled by the Axis powers at one point. And fascism was defeated by the Chinese and Russians primarily. But they gave all the credit to the British and Americans in their textbooks. However, the Chinese and Russians combined lost at minimum 37 million people, which is probably a lot higher than that. I'm going to put an estimate, actually, potentially of about 50 million people are lost between the two, between the Chinese and the Russians, which ultimately both governments, you know, ironically, both governments that defeated the Nazis are now out of power. The Soviet government, you know, fell 25 years back, and the Chinese government, the nationalists, well, they got pushed to Taiwan. They're still technically in power, I guess, but in Taiwan, while the communists took over China. However, you know, I think definitely in both countries, the memory of World War II lives on, maybe in Taiwan more when it comes to China. That was their government that defeated the Japanese. Well, their people, but they were the government in charge when they defeated the Japanese in 1945, which actually today marks the 72nd anniversary of the end of World War II. September 2nd, 1945 was the end of World War II. After 6 years and a day of the world being at war, finally the horrible nature of the war finally came to an end. Even though the last month was mostly dormant, and a lot of people consider August 15th the victory day, the day that Japan officially surrendered. But this treaty wasn't signed until September 2nd, 1945. Some odd things about the Japanese surrender compared to the Nazi surrender is that the Nazis, they were not allowed to have any kind of, supposedly, any kind of re-entrance in the politics, and they were a total disbanding of their government, while the Japanese had, they were allowed to keep their Emperor Hirohito actually live for the entirety of the Cold War. And so Japanese rise to superpower status again, and then falling back as they did in the late 80s. But, you know, the 80s, they were, a lot of people thought they were going to take over the world at one point. And then kind of China, the Made in China era arrived in the 90s, and they kind of fell out into irrelevance. And now Japan, once again, has found them in a pretty low spot. And they're dealing with a lot of problems, major societal existential problems that the Japanese society is dealing with at the moment. So it looks like they're a far cry from what they were in the past, in the 1980s and such. But Japan has an option. It's there if they want to take it. And I think they've been inching towards and inching away from America. And definitely the public opinion is inched away from America, like it has a lot of places around the world, especially in Asia, it appears, where that area is tired of living in high tension, largely in part because of the Washington, D.C. War machine. And, you know, it's just the last couple months have been really indicative of that, is that you have 1 month they're talking about North Korea, another month they're talking about Venezuela, another month they're talking about Syria and Iran. You know, there's the three major possibilities of war opening up, and the United States military is just playing with that. You know, that they're gonna do this, they're gonna do that. I feel like one of them's gonna be picked by the end of fall. It seems to be an inevitability. So with all that's happened this year, you know, also there's some major things at play. For example, you know, people don't seem to look at the economics a lot of times. But ultimately, North Korea, they have a lot of rare earth minerals, no Rothschild bank. There's multiple reasons why the United States war machine wants to go in there. It doesn't have to do with human rights. Because, again, there's no – they can't – even North Korea is probably a far leap ahead of Saudi Arabia when it comes to human rights. Anybody that defends Saudi Arabia and human rights really doesn't have any justification to call the support or to say anything else about somebody else's human rights. I mean, North Korea, they talk about, you know, a lot of these ridiculous stories. You can tell that some of them might be real and some of them might not be real. Some of the ridiculous ones have been debunked. Some defective stories have changed. There definitely seems to be something fishy with the whole way the coverage of North Korea is, like many other coverage of other countries that are not playing ball with Uncle Sam. Belarus, you know, for example, would be one of those countries where the coverage is often heavily biased. Russia, this endless Russiagate stuff that's been going on. You know, it's funny how a country that said at one point that the relationship between the United States and Russia is at the lowest point that's ever been earlier this year during the Donald Trump presidency could still be called, they're still going to say that they are collaborating with Donald Trump in secret. And another thing that's really weird is look at this. Our politicians will often say stuff like that on both sides, that Russia is just a weak regional power that will soon crumble. But on the other hand, they'll say very shortly after that Russia is a country that controls the entire Republican Party, it controls Donald Trump, it controls the Dairy Queen down the street, and it's controlling everything. You know, they put all this, you know, McCarthyist rhetoric out there about how Russia is everywhere. There's Russian spies on every corner now, and Donald Trump might be a Russian mole. You know, bringing back stuff from 1955, scare Americans of the Russian menace again. And so, and yet, but it's not communist anymore. People still think that Russia is Soviet Union. When the Soviet Union collapsed the entire 26 years ago. In fact, we just passed the anniversary of the 26th. It could have been preserved in 1991. However, hardliners attempted to seize the leadership from Gorbachev. Then after that, Gorbachev decided not to try to preserve the Soviet Union, and they worked toward the collapse of it. On December 25th, 1991, the Soviet Union, or I think it was 26th, 1991, the Soviet Union officially collapsed. And later, within 2 years, all like the original structure of the Soviet Union also collapsed. 1993, pretty much the way of governing ended too when they wrote the new constitution after the constitutional crisis. 1993 was a big transitive year towards modern Russia. The whole transition period, however, it was a battle. Yeltsin wanted a corporatist oligarch ran Russia, and there was others that didn't want that. Putin, even though that he was right under Yeltsin, didn't want that. And once he became the power, he backed away from Yeltsin's plans. You had people, you had Goldman Sachs, you had major investors and, you know, billionaires buying off property for 5% of their value during the Russian fire sale of the 90s. They called it the wild 90s. And it was a wild time indeed. People made incredible amounts of profit. Berezovsky, who worked with the Bush family, bought, believe it or not, and yes, this is true, about the entire Russian media, like all their government-ran media, their news channel or weather channel, I'm pretty sure, all that kind of shit, $50 million. That was worth $1 billion, you know, all the old Soviet media. He made $950 million profit with only putting out $50 million. That's the kind of money that these oligarchs are making off of the fire sale of the 90s. And there's going to be somebody I'll probably jump in and say, oh, but what about the free market? That's how the free market works, and you have to respect it, or else you're a commie. Bad. If you're a commie, you should go get thrown out of a helicopter. And that's where I have to say, shut the fuck up. Because I hate the people that talk about the market like it's sacred. They talk about how people worship the government oftentimes, but they worship the market practically. The market is this sacred, you know, you can't touch an all-powerful entity that if you mess with it or whatever, the whole fabric of society unwind like that. But ultimately, there's a difference between fair trade and we're working with their crony, Yeltsin, who was in the government, in order to buy off of Russia. People in the cave, not really like your average libertarian on stuff like that. Probably a shock, but also brought about by what. Like, people died, many more than that. I mean, it was a travesty of large proportion. The 90s was a dark period in comparison. It was right up there with, like, the 1940s, 1930s, when the war and stuff were happening. It was a dark period that actually saved Russia from total collapse. Because in 1998, the Russian government was near total collapse. Was falling out of the sky. It was after the collapse of the Union, and I'm pretty sure that a lot of people in 1998 were probably longing for the days of when it was at least seemed more stable during Brezhnev and such compared to that. nowadays, I think the numbers are kind of falling back down. Maybe people are getting a little bit more rational mind if they're no longer in crisis mode. Or is it perhaps people, the older generations dying off, people that grew up most of their life in the Soviet Union. However, the Soviet Union, yeah, there was definitely major problems. As I said, Stalin's purges, ultimately 1917, Jacob Schiff, Wall Street, and the Bolshevik Revolution, Red Terror, millions of people died in that. I mean, the thing was, Russia's 21st century was not very pretty. I mean, they had a lot of bad chapters when it came to the First World War, the Bolshevik Revolution, the Civil War. You had the Stalin's purges almost immediately after the Civil War ended. After Stalin's purges and the Great Patriotic War ended, came Khrushchev. And that might have been the only potentially white spot in the entire history of the Soviet Union. It seemed that Khrushchev did not want to go towards total nuclear war like some of the hardliners in the Soviet Union did. Now, a lot of the hardline internet Stalinists today, they see Khrushchev as a traitor and such. But Khrushchev was working with Kennedy towards ending the Cold War. I don't know what these internet Stalinists wanted Khrushchev to do. I don't know if they wanted Khrushchev to push it all the way. Honestly, if it would have been, like, for example, if it had been instead of one a different round, Khrushchev was never brought in, Beria took over. Thank God Beria didn't take over in Stalin's place. But imagine if it happened and Beria took over in 1953 instead of Khrushchev, and then Beria and Nixon won the election. They never let Kennedy win in 1960. The world would have been blown up by it. It would have been total fucking devastation. Beria, however, he felt the thing was him. With him is that he was he felt a disgrace. Actually, he was one of Stalin's henchmen, one of his closest right hand man. However, Beria, I think he got out. He was when Khrushchev took power, they killed him for what monster that. But he ultimately was just a person of murderers. Of the murders of the Stalin regime, believed to be a pedophile and a rapist, something of that nature. So Beria was just seen by the time. Luckily, Khrushchev was there and was able to eliminate that hound from this planet. I honestly, comparing him to a dog, that's a major insult to dogs. That thing was I don't even know what to compare Beria to, but. Khrushchev, then, you know, he exposed a lot of what was. It also changed a lot of the opinions of, I think, people that were that admired the Soviet Union. Now, some of the revolutionaries realize the Soviet Union perhaps is not any bit near a perfect example because of what. Because they realized of how far the extent of their crimes their government committed during the 1930s, 1920s. A lot of the churches were demolished. A lot of people were killed that had different opinions. I mean, people even inside the Communist Party were killed. You had the massive – anybody that Stalin didn't like was killed. And Trump, also another – he was not a good character as well. He was a massive pusher for terror on the Russian Civil War. However, ultimately, there was the infighting between Stalin and Trotsky, and Stalin ultimately used, he tried to say that he had betrayed him, and he betrayed the Soviet Union. He was he put him in trying to say that anybody that was now against him in any way was a Trotskyist, which might as well have been like, a couple of years later, called someone a Nazi or something like that. Trotsky would ultimately be assassinated in 1940 by Ramon Mercader, who worked for the NKVD, a Spanish. He was from Spain and went down to Mexico to eliminate Trotsky. Interesting fact is I actually share the same birthday with the guy. February. He was born on February 7th, 1915. I would be born 83 years later. But yeah, he would eliminate Trotsky, and then that was pretty much at the end of the purges. By then, he pretty much eliminated all political opposition. Was called, pretty much his show on the Moscow trials, where pretty much a lot of people to gulag to death for, different levels of treason and such. Pretty much just he was consolidating more power. Stalin became a very power hungry dictator, and then ultimately killed more people than Adolf Hitler by the end. I don't think it was a ridiculous number, like people try to say 50, 80 million. Some people put these impossible numbers of how many killings. I think I've even seen 100 million before. But 30 million is probably pretty reasonable, which is still a horrific amount of people that were killed by the Stalin regime. And after that, Khrushchev took power, and then they kind of went back to somewhat of the Stalinist era with some of the repression with Brezhnev. However, I don't think it was nearly severe as Stalin, but still, Brezhnev was not exactly a friend to the average revolutionary around the world. I mean, he pretty much is inaction in Bolivia. With Bolivia, he pretty much let Che Guevara get killed by the CIA and by Nazis that were hunting him down. I believe that as well. There's one, Klaus Barbie, who was working with the CIA. And Klaus Barbie, I don't know if he already had like his mercenary gang that he would later have by 1980. He had like a neo-Nazi mercenary gang that was loyal to him. And they actually helped take down the government in 1980, the government in 1980 in Bolivia. And it also was to help out drug traffickers who were working with the CIA. So it was a really nasty, dirty plot. I mean, altogether, it was just that it showed the, I mean, this is the kind of people that America's government associated with themselves with during the Cold War, with actual Nazis and terrorists and, drug traffickers, people of that nature, people like Fulgencio Batista, for example, who, he had the anti-communist police, pretty much his own secret police that eliminated back to be a communist. And this should be extremely skilled. Hey, sorry, y'all. Got disconnected there. I don't know what happened. I was doing my show, and there's been a lot of it's been like a really stormy day down here in Florida, here on the West Coast, here in the Gulf Coast of Florida. There's been, I think there's, not sure what exactly it's caused, or there's like a, I think there's a system or something off the shore, but the signal's been real bad today, my phone signal, so I hope there's no more interruptions for the rest of the show. Luckily it's nothing like what we've seen over there, with all that havoc that Harvey created over there in Texas. Can't believe some of these things, Houston and all that shit, where people are experience 5 feet of rain and stuff like that. I mean, it's incredible. And that's saying how quickly that thing intensified too before it got to shore. I was watching it on the Weather Channel. It went from the thing was just 2 days prior was predicted to only be a tropical storm at landfall. And then I was reading, or it was going to be like a Cat 1. Then they were talking it was going to be like Cat 3. Then make the landfall as a Cat 4 hurricane. I mean, that's a very powerful hurricane. It was the first Cat 4 to make landfall since Charlie in 2004. And, they have places where they show a lot of the flooding scenes. There's also a lot of wind damage. And, some of the small towns where by where it hit, rock courts. You had Port Lavaca. There was a lot of damage there. You had damage, and there's this little town. Damn, I was reading about it today. They only had like, it was a little tiny town, but they got wrecked by the hurricane. They were like right on the other side of Rockport. I'm pretty sure that poor Aransas place got really messed up by it. Sea Drifts, there's all kinds of places throughout that area. So, all around, suffered through a lot of flooding. There was some storm surge. They had the terrible flood in Houston, the fourth biggest city in the country, is now largely flooded out. I mean, it is bad. But moving on with the show, what I was saying though, yeah. And, you know, it's like we can learn with the storm is that, you know, is that you see those in these storms, it seems to bring out the community and people tend to help out each other and look past differences in ideology and differences in race and many of our other differences, and they just see they're another fellow human being. Right now, though, on the internet, you seem to be dominated by extremism. You have one side, you have people that are saying the communists deserve to die for their political ideology, but Nazis don't. On the other side, you have people saying Nazis deserve to die for their political ideology, but communists don't. But ultimately, you know, they look at it very black and white. They don't look at it like, you know, it's like ultimately, in my own opinion, I think fascism is the doctrine of evil. And our government ultimately is merger of corporate and state power. However, people for having Nazi beliefs and stuff like that, as much as I abhor Nazism and you know, neo-Nazism in this country, I don't believe they should be killed for the political ideology. I believe that they should be we should try to educate them. And if they pose any threat to us directly, then it's a different story. But however, I don't believe in attacking people that haven't been attacked first. I don't believe we should just go up and shoot them or something like that, or pick them up with helicopters. You know, like people on the far right often say about communists that they can't wait to get a helicopter so they can drop them out their helicopter. Yeah, that's, you know, they talk about the non-aggression principle. But ultimately, isn't throwing somebody out of a helicopter pretty damn aggressive? I don't know. 845-277-9223 is our call number. 845-277-9223 is the call number to Voice of Rebellion Radio. It is 45 after 3 o'clock on the East Coast. It is just about to be, it's still in 15 minutes. It'll be 1 o'clock on the West Coast here on this Saturday afternoon on Labor Day weekend, here at Voice of Rebellion Radio. And if you're listening at UCY.TV for replay, it is going to be 9:45 Eastern Time over there right now. You're listening to, and it's going to be approximately 6:45 Western Pacific Time over on the West Coast. I also do welcome all our listeners from other parts of the world besides the United States, and that might be on a different time zone, whatever time or place you're listening to. I'm glad that you've tuned in. If you're out there over there in the UK, I know we've had a few guests from there. Maybe we've attracted a few listeners from there. Definitely be a late show if you listen to the UCY replay. If you listen to the stable rate of those right now, about 9 o'clock over there at night. But that'd be, we've had a couple of guests on like 9 o'clock, about 9 o'clock Eastern Sunday time. And we've had them, you know, at the live time and had them over there at the UK. Like we had Ollie Richardson one time. You know, that was, what was it? I think it was, oh yeah, it was 2 in the morning, I believe, is when the show started, for 4 in the morning when it ended. And we had we had the same thing, like when Rosalind Fuller came over here. It was 1 in the morning when the show started over there, and the show ended at 4 for her. We had her on for like the entire 3 hours, the first time we had Rosalind Fuller here at the Stabled Radio. It's hard to believe we've had her on now 3 times, we've had a few guests from there. Now I think about it, we had, unfortunately, we were about to have the Tony Gosling, but we had the technical difficulties on that one day. I'm thinking, trying to reschedule that.
I don't know, it was like the weirdest shit was going on with my phone that day when I was supposed to interview him. And I believe there's a couple more than that I can't, or at least one more that I can't think of right now at the moment from over that way. In England or UK or something like that. Well, it's the problem with international interviews is trying to get them in the right time. You know, is that oftentimes time difference can be 6-7 hours, and that's when it starts getting a little tricky because it's, you know, what's evening for you is the middle of the night for them. What's morning for you is what's morning for you would be like when they might be still at, or early morning for you might be still when they're at work or something like that. So it's kind of hard to squeeze it in. But anyways, moving on with the show. Now, going back to the original topic, North Korea being a threat to the United States, I think the best way of defining North Korean threat, they're as much of a threat to the United States as we want them to be. If we pull out our troops, if we, for the DMZ, if we stop sanctioning them, if we bring them to the peace table, we don't have a threat. If we put more troops at the DMZ, continue putting up stat systems and paying billions of dollars to do so, if we keep pushing more crippling economic sanctions, point are just mute, really, there's no point of even doing them anymore, we are going to be poking them until the panda comes out. I guess it's a good symbolic animal for North Korea. Some people would say maybe a smaller, more cuddly animal, I guess, that acts fierce, might be more suitable for them. I think in many ways, yes, because you know, North Korean military is pretty intimidating with their size, but at the same time, I feel like they would buckle under any real large military. Maybe the United States military, it's hard to say if they invaded North Korea, it might be a different scenario than, you know, like if they were to face us somewhere else, maybe on their own territory, they would do pretty good. And with guerrilla warfare and stuff like that, because, you know, the America's military doesn't seem to have the best history with guerrilla fighters. Look at Vietnam, that we lost to a tiny little country like that. There seems to be a lot of revisionism with that as well. Is that, you know, nowadays, they've tried to blame it on so many things besides that we simply failed. That ultimately our military, it was an unwinnable war, and our military had no part in it. And, you know, people try to also say, well, no, we did have a part in it. We're trying to save just people from that brutal regime. And North Vietnam's regime was probably no more brutal than South Vietnam's regime. I mean, we all know, we all remember that iconic picture of the South Korean police chief executing that guy in the road. So I don't know why people try to make it seem like that it was so one-sided, like one side was bad, was good guys, one side was bad guys. It's one thing that Americans seem to love to do is black and white everything when it comes to when it comes to different issues. You know, if it's something either good or bad, there's no gray area. It's a very simple way to think about the world, and when it comes to, it doesn't work in geopolitics. But North Korea. And also another thing that North Korea, I believe, why they became so isolated is because it's ultimately that, again, we've done this to them. The world, a lot of the world has done that to them, and they have it's made them more fierce by isolating them. And, you know, one of the best ways to make a country, to bring down tensions, to do business with them. And we're not doing business with them. We're doing more and more sanctions to try to, now we're not even allowing tourists to come there and spend money. No, that's one thing that will drive any country to be irritated is when they're cutting into their money. And that's one thing the United States did a long time ago, and the Western world did to them a long time ago. And it's led to be disastrous. It's put the world on the brink of a major war multiple times. And, you know, this is not the only time in the last 10 years it's happened. We had the incident in Yeoping. We had multiple incidences, you know, where it got real close around 2013 when they were doing all the missile tests, how close it got then. But, again, it's not it's both sides share blame, but mostly the United States government is to blame for them becoming much more fierce and authoritarian. If they would have also started trading with them in the 1990s more, when they started implementing, when they had the famines, perhaps they would have never implemented Sogun, and maybe they might have went reversed and went, you know, they would have went from the one-party state and might have opened up towards the idea of a multi-party, at least maybe a hybrid democracy of some sort, rather than turning into a full military dictatorship. North Korea is a multi-party state, however, on parliamentary body. They have 687 seats in their parliament, and like 602 belong to the Workers' Party, but the other 85 belong to other party / independent. So there's like 50, I believe, belong to the Social Democratic Party of North Korea, which is like a light socialist party, almost kind of like some of the, I think it's a, would probably advocate for more of a democratic socialist system, maybe closer to one they have in Europe, or, you know, perhaps better, maybe like one that they have, some of the ones in Latin America. The third party, they have the Chosun Party, I believe is the name of that one, which is the, they have like, the Chinese Party, which supports the, it's the religious party. It's based on like a Japanese religion that's prominent in North Korea, and there's also independent people inside of the parliament. So there's ultimately multiple parties inside the parliament of North Korea, and there's more and rebel against the state a lot by the people. Hey, everybody. Sorry about that. Disconnected off the show there again. Yeah, there's stormy weather down here in Florida. I think it's messed with the cell tower. And a little bit, not exactly sure, but hopefully it looks like the stormy weather has been passing right now in St. Peter. There was some like heavy rain that was coming down about 30, 40 minutes ago, but now just kind of really overcast. But I'm not sure. I think there might have been like a lightning strike or something might have hit something. Last night there was a terrible lightning storm down here, and it was freaky. Like there was like I remember looking out the window. It was like that kind of thing where you could see. I think I might have saw the damn lightning bolt hitting the ground. I've heard like the electrical sound, like I heard the, and then the crack of that thunder was like, it was so fucking loud. Oh my god, that might have been, that was one of the closest I've ever been to a lightning strike, but I was inside. I don't know why it seems like a night here. It seems like they come so much closer to me. Like during the day when there's a thunderstorm, they seem to be miles away, but like night, they all concentrate on this area or something like that. Like a lot of times, wake up in the middle of the night and when there's a lightning storm, and I'll hear the booms from the lightning 2-3 times every night. Like they'll wake me up. I mean, it's also like the type of thing where you wake up all freaked out because you just hear that. It's so damn loud. It's like a sonic boom or something. But going back to what I was talking about is that. With an opening up of relations towards and a, you know, working via a diplomatic solution, and rather than tensions and, you know, rather than trying to, you know, build it up via the SAD systems and all this and all, you know, and trying to push toward what seems to be ultimately a military conclusion for the North Korea situation. If they worked towards peaceful diplomacy, I think there would have been, in the 90s at least, there would have been a possibility that they could have became a multi-party democracy of some sorts, maybe a hybrid democracy, maybe not fully functional democracy, and
the authoritarian nature of the regime that they have today would be gone, and would have, never would have happened if they. It became a necessity in part because of the Sogun kind of was a response to the famines that were in part man-made by the West and the sanctions. And ultimately, it wasn't, there was, it was weather, I believe, to an extent, but there was also a problem of that they just didn't have anyone to trade with. And when the Soviet Union fell apart, that was a major trading partner that they lost, which they had a weird relationship in themselves. The Soviet Union and North Korea weren't exactly the best of friends, and ideologically they're pretty different, but they did trade, I think, quite a bit economically. But the Soviet Union had the internationalist model of communism, while North Korea was communist, was nationalist, very with ultra-nationalist aspects to it. And they, you know, it, this is kind of evident in how you, if you look at Korean culture today, North Korea, the fact is that they still have some of the traditional Korean religions and such, like just Korean, the traditional Korean shamanism is practiced by 15% of the population in North Korea, while it's practically extinct in South Korea, and has been replaced by Catholicism and other Western religions. The other thing about North Korea that shows its traditional nature is the, you know, in many ways, I guess you could say, is their isolationist nature. And isolationism is a aspect traditional to Korea. And before, way back when it was the Korean kingdoms, they were called the Hermit Kingdom. And that's what people label North Korea as today. In many ways, North Korea is almost like a continuation of the old Korean kingdoms of the 1800s and past, going all the way to ancient times. And the idea of a strong man, kind of like a Japanese shogun or something like that, is nothing new towards North Korea. And I don't think it really was new to Asia. You know, is that ultimately every part of the world at one point had this, but I think that there's a little bit, they kept this until later, the idea of the strong man. You know, Europe had already moved towards, you know, liberal democracies as early as 1700. Some of these countries were already going towards that, with, you know, France and the French Revolution, Germany and other countries, Britain was already going towards that way, you know, on paper, the liberal democracy. But the Asia, Japan was still locked off, I'm pretty sure. In fact, I think they didn't even allow anyone to trade with them until, I think it was around the mid-1800s. They didn't allow anybody to enter. Japan was a locked-off country and closed off to the rest of the world.
I can see why, in some ways, that people want to preserve their culture. And nowadays, look at what's happened, but they've allowed so much Western influence, and it could be the end of the civilization as they know it. And what I mean by the extinction of the Japanese race is the extinction of, you know, pure-blooded Japanese people. There'll still be, of course, Japanese people. There'll still be people living in Japan, but they're going to be mixed ethnic Japanese person might be extinct very soon. And there'll be, you know, the people that'll be left will be, you know, mixed with Koreans or Chinese or from another country, but they won't be pure Japanese ethnicity,
because their birth rates have reached historical lows. You know, you have people, the birth rates in Japan are what, like 1.2, less than 1.2, I think. You know, this has also happened in Europe, you know, places where people are down, you know, the birth rates are down under 1 in many of those countries, you know, at least, you know, a lot of them are just 1-2. And, on the amount of people that are over 65 is burgeoning. It's expanding very quickly in Japan and in these European countries, which is being overtaxed on the system. It's a large part of the system that's not working, and a system that's held up by people working. So, you know, what might be the inadvertent consequences when you think about this might be the collapse of the these economic systems, replaced with something else out of necessity, because it won't work if this amount of people are working are not working because they're of elderly age. You know, these people are in their 70s, 80s. Japan, a lot of people think are in their 90s or past the century mark. I mean, there's a lot of very old people in Japan. Their life expectancy, I believe, is 85.
which is like they got like a 10 years on the United States in life expectancy, so which is a pretty high when you talk about averages. I mean, that's 12.5% more than the United States. Life expectancy plus the United States, a lot of times those anything over 60 is sick years. Are they really living if you're on so many pills and on hospital machines and stuff like that, like a lot of old people are. And I think they live much healthier, especially when they live on those villages. But well, the Japanese life expectancy is, I was right, it's 85. And they only have 5 years on America. We're at 78, apparently, as of 2015. These are some of 2015. The United States is at 78. China's at 83. Some other top countries. England, or the United Kingdom's above us, believe it or not, they're at 81. Australia is above us at 82. And, you know, there's life expectancies are kind of weird, though. You look at it, you see, like, countries like Russia, where the Russian male life expectancy, I don't know if it's still as low as it was back before, but at one point it was as low as 59, I believe. I think it was after when, you know, like millions of people starved to death in the 90s after the famine that pretty much took place. Where life expectancy dropped down, women were like at 70, life expectancy, and men were down to like 60. That's still pretty low, 64 actually in Russia. Life expectancy for men at 64 in Russia, it's a place among the lowest 50 countries in the world in that category. Wow. Overall, a quarter of Russian men died before reaching 55, but see, they're still left over from the old. A lot of people are people that grew up in the Soviet Union and such and lived some very rough years in there. And, you know, talk about the 80s, the 90s. So it's, it can't really, I don't know if you can really, it's hard to count that when a whole era lives through such a terrible time in there. I don't know if you can count at the same country where they haven't went through the nearly the same kind of hardships, but that overall a quarter of men die before, the other thing that brings it down is accidents, the thing, to die before reaching 55, a quarter of them. That's a lot of people, I think, die from accidents, you know, car crashes. You have a pretty big problem with alcohol that's, you know, coming down, but still, their overall life expectancy is pretty much on par with a lot of the regular first world countries. One,
women are living much longer
than men, I guess. That must mean that if it's half and half, and the men are 64, the overall is 71, that means that women are 78. Pretty big difference. 14-year life expectancy difference between men and women in that country. That's pretty surprising. But now, let's also look into another thing. Let's look at what they call one of the poor countries. I wonder. I don't know. But again, these numbers can always be fudged, and that's why it's kind of hard to trust stats. That, I mean, I'm just going off of what literally Google brings up when you
type up in that first thing at the top they bring, that first result. You know, it's like research art, or you don't even have to click on a website to see that thing. That's what these little searches I'm doing right now are. Deep into it, but okay, look at a poor country like Cuba, where they say the second poorest country in the Western Hemisphere.
They oftentimes talk about the failures of their system. They're because these money is more than the United States. They got almost 79.55 American, 78.74. They're like one of the top 10 countries on the planet, or something like that. They also have one of the highest literacy rates and everything, but the second highest in Latin America, which I wonder who is the highest. I had them a little bit curious about who would be higher than Cuba. I'm going to guess Chile, possibly, or So I was right my first time. Chile, where's Uruguay at then? Let's see. I think it was number 4. I'm not far. Uruguay was 77, and Chile 80.51. I knew it was good. I was not too far off, but. And then where my country, Colombia, where they're at, they're not too bad as well. They're at the 75 almost now, but they're still 75th ranked in the world, believe it or not. Wow, that's crazy. I mean, America slipped all the way down. If we're only at 38, we must be, because they have 30 Costa Rica, and they're at 79.61. Panama 77.82. So they're somewhere between 30 and 37, the United States. Pretty much in the same ballpark. Again, it's the same ballpark with countries like Ecuador, Peru, not far behind Brazil, Nicaragua, not a whole ways away. I mean, I think Cuba's the second poorest country on the planet, but I'm pretty sure Nicaragua, or in the Western Hemisphere, but I believe Nicaragua is not much further behind. I mean, I think Nicaragua's poorer than Cuba, actually. I'm not sure where they get, because Nicaragua as a country, I mean, they went through the Civil War in the 80s, and I don't think they quite ever recovered. They have a lot of problems with poverty still, as they do in all Central America. However, it's been, they're better than a lot of other countries in Central America. However, they're seen as a pretty poor country. I mean, I think a lot of people's job is like 50. I don't know. They try to show that, at least in like Anthony Bourdain, which I know is like a propaganda show practically. But they try to show kids are sifting through trash. Apparently, to make a living for the family or something like that. That probably was a rare occurrence, and they were just bringing about one of the few examples. But anyways, anybody that wants to call in, going back to see you right now, walking on the radio. We got about 15 minutes left here. Oh, okay, sorry everybody that experienced the technical difficulties here. There was again, got cut off. So didn't expect to have as much trouble after. I thought it was the rain pass and everything that made perhaps. I don't know what exactly stopped in it. Cause it's like I have like all the Wi-Fi says it's good. Cell signal is not too great. I guess it could be pressed by the storms. It's funny that right when like there, I heard like a thunder rumbling in the background, and then the call disconnected. So I don't know if like the cell tower around here's hit or something last night or something like that, or maybe there's a power outage. Like at one point, like prior to the show, like I wasn't getting any cell signal at all here, which I never get the best cell signal, to be honest. Here it's like I have the cheapest cell plan practically you can get, called Getro PCS or Metro PCS. It's like the cheapest, but it's also like there's a reason why it's so cheap. But hopefully we'll stay alive for the rest of the show without any more interruptions. Also, Blog Talk Radio. Or something like that. Blog Talk Radio has had a history of problems with Blog Talk Radio in the past. I don't know why I still I do it because it's the only recording. I can't. My phone has a little memory. Do it this way. And, you know, I have to do it via service online. Because if I'd store it on my phone, I think it just wouldn't even work. I think it would be out of space. Like, literally, I'm at that brink of the phone where it's almost about to give me that warning message, but it's like, I have to, like, delete stuff all the time. It's like, that's another bad thing about, you know, I usually rip on people that buy, like, the phones, even if you buy something that's, like, $120. Like, wow, it's like, I got my phone for $20. And I realize why. These smartphones are $20 sometimes, or this one's $40, is because they have no freaking memory whatsoever. It's ridiculous. And also,
But talk about not getting your money's worth. Blog Talk Radio is $40 a month. I really hope the problems are not coming from their end, because it's $40 a month. I mean, that's as much as like a, that's almost as much as like a crappy satellite TV service. And oh shit, we got some kind of busy signal or something like that on the end. Hopefully, we stay on the air here. I'm hoping that's not Metro screwing with me or something like that. Like, what happened last time where we had the, what was it, 2 times ago where I had like a 15-minute interruption. I was like,